Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, celebrating the June solstice. And a scientist speaks on sustainability 20 years after the Earth Summit in Rio. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Right now, from the Northern Hemisphere, the sun is making its highest path across the sky, lowest path across the sky from the Southern Hemisphere.
That's renowned sky watcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
NASA announced on June 12th that the Cassini spacecraft orbiting Saturn has spied long-standing methane lakes, or puddles, in the tropics of Saturn's moon Titan. This moon of Saturn is the only place in the solar system besides Earth that has large bodies of liquid on its surface. In this case, the liquid isn't water, it's methane. Cassini spacecraft found methane lakes around Titan's poles in 2007. Now it appears the tropics of Titan have lakes too.
UK researchers have recently shown that highly sociable Australian birds called Gouldian finches have different personalities according to the colors of their heads. Researchers say that red-headed birds have aggressive tendencies. Meanwhile, finches with black heads are bold and take more risks than their peers.
New evidence from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory challenges prevailing ideas about how supermassive black holes grow in the centers of galaxies. Astronomers have long thought that a supermassive black hole and the bulge of stars at the center of its host galaxy grow at the same rate. The bigger the bulge, the bigger the black hole. A new study of Chandra data has revealed two nearby galaxies whose supermassive black holes are growing at a rate that is faster than the rate of the growth of the galaxies.
An international team of scientists has identified a unique set of cells in the cervix that are the cause of human papillomaviruses, or HPV, which are related to cervical cancers. Significantly, the team also showed that these cells do not regenerate when excised. These findings have immense clinical implications in the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of cervical cancer. The study was published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Nitrogen pollution is giving carnivorous plants on Swedish bogs so many nutrients that they don't need to catch as many flies. The common sundew grows in rain-fed bogs across much of Northern Europe. These habitats have few nutrients, so the plants need to boost their nitrogen intake by trapping midges and other insects with their sticky leaves. A study published in New Phytologist shows that nitrogen pollution is essentially providing fertilizer for the plants. It's making these carnivorous plants lose interest in insect prey. That's our news of the week. I'm Emily Howard.
I'm Michael Brennan. Song of the week this week is by Sleep Good. It's off their brand new 7-inch titled Monsanto. This song's called Summer Explosion.
Oh,
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird is here with news of the global night sky, a solstice to celebrate. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. Of course, this is the winter solstice in the southern hemisphere and the summer solstice for us in the northern hemisphere, both of which people celebrate the winter solstice because it's the shortest day of the year and the days are going to start lengthening again, and the summer solstice because, hey, it's summer.
Right? Awesome. Yeah. So what, Deborah, what is a solstice?
Well, the sun, of course, just is moving through the galaxy doing its thing at all times. The sun is not doing anything special, anything different. But to us on Earth, it appears as if it's doing something special. So what's happening is, the fact is that Earth is tilted on its axis by 23.5 degrees, and we all learned that in school, but it actually has some very real world ramifications. And one of those is our seasons. If Earth orbited exactly upright with respect to the plane of its orbit around the sun, we would still have sort of climate based on how far you were from the poles, but we wouldn't have the four seasons that we have now. And those seasons are caused by the fact that Earth is tilted on its axis. So what's happening right now is that Earth's north pole is tilted most toward the sun. The south pole is tilted most away. So summer in the north, winter in the south. And on the day of the solstice, the sun in our sky, which of course is shifting back and forth as it's making its daily path from east to west across the sky, that path that the sun makes changes throughout the year. And right now, from the northern hemisphere, the sun is making its highest path across the sky, lowest path across the sky from the southern hemisphere.
And Deborah, what does the solstice look like? I understand it's a moment. It's actually a moment when this happens. But what can people look for during this solstice?
Well, first of all, that moment is just the moment that the sun reaches its farthest north on the celestial sphere, which is the imaginary dome of sky around Earth. And that moment is going to occur on June the 20th. At 23:09 UTC, that's 6:09 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the United States. So, you know, 23:09 UTC, you need to translate that to your time zone depending on where you are in the world. But yeah, around the time of the solstice, there's a whole array of things that go on. We talked about one of those things last week, the earliest sunrises of the year for the northern hemisphere and the earliest sunsets of the year for the southern hemisphere happen a week or two before the summer solstice. So if you're hearing this before the solstice, you may be in a place where those very early sunrises or very early sunsets are still going on.
And this corresponds to it being, for us in the northern hemisphere here in Austin, Texas, it's the longest day. And for people down under, it's the shortest day.
That's right. And so what's cool about the solstice to me is that, you know, after the solstice, it begins to change. Like, you can really see that it's shifting the other way again. So the days here in the northern hemisphere will be getting shorter and shorter. Of course, yay for the people in the southern hemisphere. The days are getting longer again for them. But, the shift is going on all the time, very noticeable at this time of year around the solstice.
And besides noticing the sunlight changing a little bit, there are other things to look for as well, right?
Well, one of the interesting things about the solstice, and people always ask about this, around the summer solstice, like, why is it that the longest day of the year comes in June, but the hottest weather doesn't come until a month or 6 weeks later? And the answer to that is something that we all sort of experience, and that is, the weather from day to day, the hottest weather of the day isn't at noon when the sun is highest in the sky. The hottest weather of the day tends to be like 3 p.m, or here in Texas, it's sometimes even 5 p.m, until you get that hottest time of the day. And likewise with the year, the hottest weather of the year doesn't happen when the sun is at its highest. Because the land and the oceans take a while to heat up, like it takes them a while after the winter to sort of lose their cold and get some heat. And that's why in the summer, it starts out kind of mild and then gets hotter and hotter and hotter.
Yeah, awesome. So this is a great time also, I think, to impress your friends during this solstice and explain to them why we have seasons. It's not due to our the fact that Earth is farther away from the sun, is it?
Right. In fact, if Earth orbited upright, if we go back to that image again of Earth not tilting on its axis, it would change a little bit because Earth's orbit is not exactly circular. But most of the seasons are happening because of that tilt. And in fact, Earth is farthest from the sun in July. So Earth is farthest from the sun when it's summer in the northern hemisphere. So, hey, there you go.
And don't forget to celebrate this solstice, summer solstice here for people northern hemisphere, winter solstice for people down in Australia, New Zealand, down under.
I know I'll be celebrating.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky, we interview the world's top scientists. It's been 20 years since the historic Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, which led to historic agreements on climate change and environmental pollution such as leaded gasoline. In 2012, world leaders once again gather for the Rio+20 Summit to rally for a common blueprint to balance human population and consumption with what the environment can support. In advance of the Rio+20 Summit, biologist Paul Ehrlich co-authored a paper in the science journal Nature that explored how humanity can sustain itself through the 21st century. On the line now to explain his findings is Paul Ehrlich. Dr. Ehrlich, welcome.
Great to be here.
Now, it's been 20 years since the historic Earth Summit in Rio, where world leaders met to rethink how to grow their economies in line with the environment. What message do you as a scientist have for the world now?
Well, the message is, of course, they haven't accomplished that, but they were trying an impossible thing. That is, we're already way, way beyond the carrying capacity of the planet, even with many people living in misery. And there is no way to grow your economy and also maintain your long-term ability to survive as a civilization.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that carrying capacity and population. Dr. Ehrlich, your latest paper in the science journal Nature examines how Earth, population 7 billion now in 2012, can get to a sustainable size. What did you find?
Well, the way you can get to a sustainable size, first of all, is to start gradually reducing both population size and the amount each person consumes, because the best estimates we can make are that with present technologies, you might be able to support 1.5 billion people permanently on the planet, and we are 7 now, and we're going to add, if the projections are correct, 2.5 billion people by 2050. That means we're going to add many more people than were alive when I was born in 1932. And most people don't recognize that the additional people are going to have a disproportional impact on our life support systems, because people are smart. We started out using the richest resources. We farmed the bottomlands. We drank water just fresh out of the rivers, which was clean. And as we have grown, of course, we've had to go to poorer and poorer resources so that, for instance, each person now has to be fed from more marginal land, get resources from poorer sources. For instance, when we started with copper, we had it 100% lying around on the ground, and now we're mining ores at 0.5%. So we are pushing in exactly the wrong direction. And unless we change our ways, the scientific community has said many times that civilization just isn't going to persist.
One of the concepts that you explore in this paper for Nature is the concept of natural capital, putting a price on nature for the services it gives.
It's understanding that, for example, humanity is utterly dependent on flows of things that we get from nature, from natural ecosystems. Natural capital, things like our deep, rich agricultural soils, which are being eroded away at very much more rapidly than they're being reformed. Fossil groundwater all over the world. We're pumping out aquifers at rates beyond what they're they can be recharged. And the biodiversity that runs our life support systems, which is disappearing at something on the order of a couple thousand times the historic rate, and of course not being regenerated at any significant rate. So basically, our natural capital is something that we have not priced, but should be pricing, and we should be paying much more attention to it, and basically we're paying none. And we have a situation where most economists and most politicians think the cure to our problems is growth, when actually that's the disease. And our natural capital, among other things, for instance, includes the forests that absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that should be being regrown everywhere, but they're still being cut down. So we got to learn, our politicians have to learn to evaluate our natural capital, and people have to get behind them to make sure that they do everything possible to preserve the things that are critical to us. For example, we are losing our pollinators. In the United States, the last estimate I saw was that pollinators of our crops provide something on the order of $20 billion worth of value, and it's something we're destroying without really thinking about it.
Well, Dr. Ehrlich, you've said recently that just telling people what the science says hasn't brought about the changes we need. What will?
We formed a thing called the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere, which is trying to get not just natural scientists, but social scientists, people in the humanities, people in society in general, in business and so on, together to try and figure out how to change our behavior. Because, of course, despite the continual lies put out by a certain segment of our society, climate change is just one of many extremely serious problems, and it's getting worse every year. We're putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere every year. And fortunately, social scientists know a lot about how to change human behavior, but it's not being applied. One of the things, for example, that we can do maybe to totally solve the population problem and get our population gradually shrinking is to give full rights to all women everywhere, make sure they have the same pay, all the same opportunities, and so on, and they will have many fewer babies if that happens. And so simply working for women's rights is one thing that everybody can do to try and solve the overall problem of our overshoot, of being far beyond the capacity of the planet to support even today's population in the long term.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about human sustainability?
The most important thing about human sustainability is that we are going to have to find ways to gradually and humanely reduce the size of our population, to stop the growth of our economy, and to see to it that people who need more consumption get it, but that the rich learn to consume less. We are going to have to reduce our level of consumption. There are lots of ways to do that that could be very pleasant and make all of our lives better.
You've been listening to biologist Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Byrne. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Sleep Good, The Black and White Years, 100 Flowers, and The Bright Light Social Hour. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But what we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't know.